What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I have Polly Wynne Jones, who's a global knowledge manager with a focus on creative and media at Kantar. Polly has worked at Kantar for about 40 years. Today we are going to chart the history of humor in advertising, at least over the past couple of decades. And this is a follow-up episode to an interview I did with Paul Fisher, who's the Chief Strategy Officer of BBDO in Dublin, where he had posted on LinkedIn a rhetorical question with like 5% bemoaning energy. No offense, Paul, you know what I'm talking about. Like, what's going on? About like, why do people keep talking about the decline in humor in advertising? And it's interesting because Polly's going to talk about this. Polly has written two articles in the past two-ish years about the decline and then potentially a return. And apparently at Cannes a few months ago, Andrew Robertson, who's the global CEO of BBDO, was also talking a lot about humor as well as citing a lot of the Kantar research. So we're going to dig into that today. Polly, how did you come to be doing what you do?
Firstly, I must just point out I haven't been here for 40 years. I've actually been here for just over 30 years.
Okay, 30 years. So how did you come to be doing what you're doing?
Purely by accident. I did a fine art and printmaking degree in London when I was young, and then I quickly learned to type because in those days you had to earn money. And I went via an agency and said, send me where they'll pay me the most money to type. And it happened to be a company called Millward Brown, which was the precursor to Kantar. And then I ended up here typing, and I've kind of worked my way around the company in and out of various jobs. Until I've 30 years later, I sit and I make art out of the data now. So,
you know what? I've never spoken about this in public, but typing and secretarial skills were one of the main ways that a lot of women could enter the workforce for a while, correct?
Definitely, yes. 30 plus years ago.
Yeah, I know that because my mom used to teach shorthand writing. I think she was like a shorthand writing champion, and she would talk about this. How difficult was it to, first of all, get into that kind of role and then to progress when you were starting out?
We were sort of the head office. I'm actually based in Warwick in the Midlands in the UK, and we were the head office in the company Millward Brown, and Maurice Millward and Gordon Brown worked here with us. So it was a smaller company, so you got to know everybody and you got to learn from everybody quite quickly and easily. So the first few years, it was actually quite easy to progress up into actually looking at the data, working with it, doing analysis. And I just got really interested in it. I love working out people, how they understand things, how they react to things. That was how it developed.
I just wanted to poke a little bit around like the kind of sexist construct. You know, hey, ladies, you can go to finishing school, you can get some secretarial skills, you can learn shorthand typewriting, and that's how you might get a foot in a quote-unquote white-collar. I'm really uncomfortable with that as an idea, but a white-collar job.
But market research was quite a new industry then, and one of the nice things about it was there were a lot of women in it. I mean, at fair dues, like in most companies, that the more senior people were generally men, but it was quite a female-dominated industry altogether. It wasn't that difficult at the time. It was difficult to become senior, but you worked with a lot of people like you, so...
So we're going to talk about humor and advertising today. Is this an area that you specialize in? Is it a big part of your work life? And also kind of connected to that is that how did you come to be writing about it and focusing on it as a topic?
I moved from typing into the databases. So I was actually involved in having access to all the data that the company was collecting. And I focused on the ad testing data. So literally the data that comes in from all the creatives that we research. And I was initially for quite a number of years involved in the databases. So when an ad's tested, we pick up all the data about it, whether it's got humor in it, whether it's got animals in it, whether it's for new brands or everything you can think about. And that is matched with the data so that we have this great wealth of information. And I just slowly started looking at it and extracting things from it to try and find interesting learnings to help clients, really. Humor is one of many topics that I'd cover. It just really came to the fore, I think, with the articles after COVID. We saw this decline and we did this COVID barometer, it was called. And we looked at whether people actually wanted advertising to stop being funny or whether we should just stop advertising because COVID wasn't a great time. And actually they said, no, we want normality. We do want to see humor. So carry on using it. So that's why it kind of developed into this article. That's it's actually probably the one article I've written that's been picked up on the most. A lot of people have asked about it since it was first put out. So that's why I did the follow-up. So
why do you think people have picked up on it the most?
Because we saw humor declining. And it was like, why? And this is a steady decline because we go way back. It's like 10, 15 years worth of slow decline. And why were ads no longer funny? We're very aware of the news now. You know, there's always something terrible going on. And then a pandemic and recessions and wars and everything. And I just think people just felt too scared. I think advertisers became too scared to actually use humor, because they were worried about it being inappropriate. So
I moved to New York in 2011, and I was taken aback by how serious and kind of robotic the work culture was in advertising and also in marketing groups at the time. There were some funny ideas that I saw, but it just felt so serious. I think the decline in humor is one. I personally like humor, and I don't want a workplace or an advertising culture or maybe even a business culture that takes itself too seriously. So I've seen that. It was explained to me a little bit based on September 11. And then obviously the, well, what Aussies call the GFC, the global financial crisis, 2008 and 2009, as leading to like this drop. And also around that time, more activism in the US, advertising a yogurt and you use the wrong color of, not color, that's not the example. Like you just use the wrong word and all of a sudden you're getting attacked by all kinds of people. I didn't mean to say color because I wasn't talking about race. I was just trying to come up with a random thing. So I think it works on two levels. One is for a lot of us in the industry, it's just like you're in these, intuitively, you might spend a lot of time with stand-up comedy or comedic movies, and you know that that stuff gets attention and attracts you. Two, your work environments are often very serious these days, and there is a lot of serious stuff going on. And then three, you suspect that it works in advertising. That's sort of a subjective tracking of it. You've actually tracked numerically the rise and fall of data. And it's funny because in 2011 in your chart, it apparently dropped the use of data of humor in advertising. Explain the past couple of decades, the ebbs and flows of humor in advertising.
The chart that you've probably come across, it's in the articles and it's been reshown in lots of places, is the one that highlights the recession, the global recession in 2009. And we saw a very definite dip then. Then it kind of slowly carried on declining. We got to COVID and it obviously started declining again. It's literally just this last year that seems to have steadied a little bit. And within the main chart that people are seeing, that's data that comes from TV ads, digital ads, print and outdoor ads and things. It's the whole, all of them together. It's actually TV is steadying and starting to lift a little, but print ads are still staying, you know, they're still falling and having less humor in, and also digital. So
I have a feeling because television advertising, largely speaking, is probably still reserved as like a tier one, need the big teams around it, and then everything else relative to, say, 20 years ago, maybe that print ad could be just put into the design studio or the creative services team can take care of it. And so I think there's probably a different kind of person maybe working on it.
Yes. People also tend to spend more money on researching TV ads because they've spent more making them. But at the end of the day, with the testing that we now do, it's very fast and flexible. You can do link AI testing. So you actually literally just testing it using machines that have programmed all the data from our databases to actually assess from everything we've historically learned, a bit ChatGPT-ish, but from our own data. So that's very cheap and fast and easy. And then you've got the more specific Link Plus data, which it can test the TV ads, the digital and the print and outdoor ads. And that's actually tested with real humans. We haven't lost the humans altogether yet. With the humor, if people are worried about using it, it's quite easy to just quickly run it through a check thing, especially with TV where you're spending a lot of money. You're going to spend a lot to actually put it out there. Checking that you haven't actually completely misfired and you've hit the wrong people with your humor. I think that's really important. And people do it with TV. We do a lot of that. We now do a lot of digital testing, but still not enough because people think of it as the sort of poor relation, I think, to TV a little bit. But, you know, it's just as effective. We're in a digital world. People are seeing it digitally, probably more than TV these days. I've no idea, but
Yeah, I mean, often different teams, different budget owners. I wonder if we'll ever get to the point where we'll have truly lost the plot and we'll have machines making advertising that will get tested with machines to see if machines will go buy the things that the machines are advertising.
Exactly what we've just done this year. We have an article on machines scoring machines. We literally found ads that had been made by AI and we tested them through Link AI, which has been built on all of our previous learning. Some of them are really weird. Some of them were fantastic. They were like a hybrid. So there was a Coke one, I seem to remember, in like a gallery where it leapt in and out of the paintings in the gallery. But that worked beautifully. And then there was this other one that just had random words thrown into it because the machine had thought, we need this and we need that and we need an animal and we need something, a bit of humor and this, ticking lots of boxes and threw them all in and it was just a big chaos. So the machines haven't learned quite how to do it yet, but they're on their way.
I was thinking it's like, you know, let's say you like playing tennis, but instead of playing tennis, you get two robots to play it. And then I thought what would make the machine thing even funnier is if you got machines making the ads, those ads are getting tested on machines, then we want to see if machines are going to buy the ads. And then there's like other machines making reaction videos on YouTube to the whole thing.
Yes, I don't think we've got that stage yet.
It'll come. So humor is an enhancer of receptivity. That's a phrase that you use. What are the other enhancers of receptivity?
Well, we looked at things like whether there's slogans in the ad, whether there's music, different elements. And yes, humor was actually coming out at the top. That chart was done using our ad reaction data from a number of years ago. So I don't have in front of me on all the other receptors, but I do recall that that was at the top. And I think music was pretty close up at the top too, close after that, because music's a massive part of whether you even watch an ad, I think, whether you're just going to scroll past it or whether you'll stop and listen because you love the tune. I mean, it's another enhancer of receptivity, definitely.
Right. So the enhancers of receptivity are not just based on a tone in the advertising or even an emotional response. It could be things, as you were saying, like slogans, music, humor. So there's like a mixed category.
Yeah, they're the different creative enhancers that we would have picked out when we looked at what you're being receptive, what's making you more receptive. It was basically different characteristics within advertising as a whole rather than how you feel about it. That's another side to it.
So January 2022, your article comes out and you talk about how humor has been in decline, up and down, but largely in decline over the past couple of decades. And then you compare the overall set of data to data from the Kantar Creative Effectiveness Award winners. What were you seeing in your compare and contrast task there?
We launched the Creative Effectiveness Awards. We actually started working on it with data from 2019. And so we're all due to launch in March 2020. But you'll remember something else happened there. In the UK, we went into lockdown. So we stopped the launch and then we did it in June, quite quietly later in the same year. But we've actually done that. We've had the awards every single year. Next year will be our fifth awards, which we're going to celebrate at the Cannes Festival. But every year we notice that most of our winners, or a big chunk of our winners, would have some element of humour. We record if an ad is funny, lighthearted, or it has no intended humour. And then we looked at them and we realised that usually over half of them were funny. These awards, basically, they're judged by people. They're judged by consumers because we look at all the ads that were tested in the year and then which ones scored the highest across lots of different things, long-term and short-term metrics. So it's actually people saying, these are the best ads of the year, and they had humor in. And then you would look at some of the other awards over this period, and there was a lot of quite sadvertising, we called it. Difficult subjects being broached with brands connecting and just far less humor. And we were finding that the people actually wanted more, because I feel like our awards are what the people want, not necessarily what the experts are saying is great. So that's why that part was in, basically. Yeah, it sort of covers the fact that there were more humor with our winners.
In defense of one piece of advertising that I really love, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a campaign for a German supermarket called Penny, which has a boy and his mom and et cetera. And he asked, you know, what do you want for Christmas this year? And it's like this long, very, very indulgent, but very, it's lovely, long video or story about, like, I just wish that you were a teenager and going out and getting drunk and falling in love and having your heart broken. And then
I think I have seen it, yeah.
I have a 17-year-old, so I cry when I watch that, and I sneak it into my little workshop so I can cry.
There is nothing wrong with sadvertising. I'm not saying that that shouldn't be used. I'm just saying there was too much of it. There became too much of it, and I think a balance needed addressing. And I mean, it does have a purpose, but it needs to have a true purpose and be really well connected for it to be effective. But emotional connection is key, but you can connect emotionally with humor as well.
You know, I like an ad that does what the kids would say, a bit of trauma bombing. Anyway, so you have a taxonomy for humor styles, and there are 6 humor styles in your taxonomy here. I have them in front of me, but can you run us through them?
Let's start with slapstick. And for that, I kind of think of Mr. Bean. Rowan Atkinson in any type of advertising, you know, he travels the world because he's not even speaking, so we don't have to worry about understanding him. He's a great example of humor that can travel in a slapstick way, who everybody loves, I think.
Smart person. Hey, pull your mind out of those timesheets for a second and take a look at the Sweathead website. We have 3 membership levels, Starter Mode, Flight Mode, and Beast Mode. They give you access to a variety of strategy masterclasses, conferences, accelerators, and online learning, some of which has been known to make people cry because they like it, they like it, they feel seen. Make the most of your mind this year or any year and visit www.sweathead.com today. Now back to the interview.
I was thinking about some of the Super Bowl advertising over the years, and I don't know if this scenario actually happened. You know, slapstick advertising for me, getting kicked in the nuts. All right, just in case you're new to that term, somewhere in the world, which I doubt. What else do you have?
You have dark humor, which is another one that people are more nervous to use, but if it's the right for your brand, and there are brands it is right for, you do need to be brave and try to use it. Like I said, there's lots of things to catch you along the way if you fall. But if you start by, I talked about using comedians to actually test your humor, because if you're aiming it at particularly niche groups, which some dark humor may be aimed at, comedians, they try and test out humor. They test it, and if something falls, they know. And so they kind of sense what will and won't work. So actually using proper comedians to write your humor is a good idea, I would think, especially with dark humor.
Totally. Most comedians hate advertising, and they don't think copywriting is a very highly skilled profession. I know that because I watch and listen to a lot of podcasts with stand-up comedians. There's an example of dark humor from Special Forces, an agency that's at least in New Zealand. I'm going to get them on and talk to them soon. I'll mis-explain what they did, but that's okay because we'll work it out in the future. I think they were advertising something to do with retirement funds or superannuation or insurance, something like this. And they created these really, like, basically dead people speaking, I think. And then they placed them. But then the placement was kind of what's funny. I think they placed them around television shows where there are a lot of murders happening and things like that. Do you know this case study better than I do?
You know, we all watch crime drama these days, or I certainly do. A lot of my friends do. And the person who dies in it, at the end of the ad, they were sort of coming to life, and they always said, well, I wasn't expecting that. Should have got life insurance. That was a great one, and a great use of dark humor that everybody could then laugh about. That was a fantastic campaign. I think it won awards, which is probably why we know about it, yeah.
Very Monty Python, very Monty Python. And for the record, I don't know if you've seen the meme that's been going around about, you know, how often men think about ancient Rome or the Roman Empire. I think however often men think about the Roman Empire is how often women, and I know I'm being heteronormative, the equivalent for women is crime television.
Yeah, I probably agree with that.
I've talked about it, and then people are like, that's because women have to worry about being safe on the streets all the time. They don't call me an arsehole, but I think sometimes that they want to say that.
I love it because I love puzzling things out. That's kind of why I do the job I do as well. So
love it. So we got slapstick, and then we've got dark humor. We've got 4 more.
We've got wordplay, one that's really cleverly used to actually amplify your brand, because if you put your brand into that, into the wording of the wordplay, I've just actually written an article on play, and I talked about how we get a dopamine rush trying to work things out. We can actually enjoy having to puzzle out a little puzzle like that. That can work really well. And it works on, you know, advertising on Snapchat, for example. There's a lot of the ads on Snapchat will have words written on them. So there's quite a lot of puns and things like that, which can incorporate wordplay. I'm trying to think of one.
Well, I got one. It's for a toilet paper brand in the US. And I think their tagline now is like, that's the sheet.
Oh, clever. Yeah. Yeah. Nothing to work out on that one, though. Sometimes put it in a puzzle.
Let's do three more.
Satire and irony. We've always collected, and I've never sure if it travels. So if does somebody in India or Timbuktu understand what I'm talking about when I say satire or irony? And do I even understand what the difference between the two are? So it's a more clever sort of humor. We used to have laddish. That's another one that we collected. And it was always beer ads. So
I was actually going to say, oh, g'day, mate, get this beer into
there's a lot of Australian laddish humor. To be honest, Australia just do humor well.
you. We do, and sometimes I cringe looking at back at some of the old ads because they're just like a bunch of white men, super jingoistic. Sort of stuck in this like 1970s idea of what it was to be an alpha male. I'm talking about like 20 years ago. I don't know. I have a very soft spot for the Australian advertising world.
And New Zealand, I mean, one of our winners last year was Air New Zealand, and it was the goose who, instead of flying old school and actually migrating in the air, he'd hopped on the plane and he's got his movie going and that, and he looks out the window and laughs at all his other geese flying old school. That was a fantastic ad. I don't know how you'd describe that humour. For me, it's just a fun humour.
Let's settle with the five for now. We have slapstick, dark humour, wordplay, satire, irony, and laddish.
Yeah, we can think up more as we go along.
Totally, totally. I love how your article from this year, there's a subheading, intention is not enough to make consumers laugh out loud. And if you've ever tried to make a dad joke, also gendered, or is it these days? I don't know. We all know that this is true. This is true. But we still want points. We want points for like making those dad jokes. Can you tell us what you wrote about more recently? Like, what's the state of humor now?
Well, basically, it's like I said, we collected the database whether the ad was funny, lighthearted, or no intended humor, which doesn't mean it didn't have any. But this is kind of assessed by the ad agency, the client, us. And so that gets ticked as a box and that will pull out the data. And when we look at that data, ads that are funny or lighthearted, they are more engaging and they are more distinctive, but they're not necessarily persuasive or better remembered or better branded. By then, more recently, we had enough data to look at this laugh out loud question, which we actually asked of the respondents. So this is people on the street, this is the real people. And they assessed it that basically the ads that were really at the top scale of laughing out loud, this really did make me laugh out loud. Yes, they were better. Again, they were more engaging, they were more distinctive, but they were actually more persuasive, which is kind of a lot of what we're trying to do with advertising. They were more persuasive and they were better branded. So the fact that it really made them laugh, especially if the brand is built around the humor, that's quite key. They're obviously more effective altogether. They're going to connect with your brand. You're going to remember them. And actually, you might go and buy it because it made you laugh.
Obviously, a lot of that's about getting into the system one part of the brain, emotional priming, etc. Do you know much about the psychology of, well, laughter, but also of humor, like what's going on when we laugh out loud? I have theories and I've read some stuff.
I just think it's a dopamine rush, isn't it?
Well, I mean, humor, comedy, a similar thing, but maybe not always exactly the same thing. I mean, it largely operates through violations of norms. So bringing things together in a way that don't belong together that might create new meaning, but hopefully in this situation in a comedic way rather than a fearful way, right? I believe, because when I'm working with strategists, I'm like, listen to whether when you're in a room talking about your research, listen to whether people snort or giggle or they're like, watch for the body language, because to me, they're little glitches. I'm looking for those glitches. I mean, stand-up comedians build their careers on those kinds of glitches. They'll record themselves on stage. They'll listen for the number of laughs. Some of them are aiming for a certain number of laughs per minute, 5 to 10 maybe. And so those sounds and the body language to me, little glitches that are leading indicators that you should work with the thing that you're thinking about rather than back off into something that's plain, flat, and serious. That's my theory. How do you feel about that?
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I said the comedians, their job is reading a room, isn't it? And then they're assessing all the time what's working. I mean, we also have what you call facial coding, which is where we record the face of people whilst they're watching advertising. And then we split that into whether they're smiling, whether their eyebrow raised, whether they're frowning, the whole host of different movements within a face. And so we can actually do further analysis exactly to see if you've got humor in your ad, but is everyone starting to smile at the wrong bit or did it land in the right place? So actually there's a really detailed breakdown when you do your link test, you get this facial coding built into it. And you can really pull it to pieces that way to just check how a face is moving as it's going through the actual watching of the ad. Very clever stuff.
I wonder what the differences between cultures or countries are. I often joke that Aussies, at least me, I don't really use my facial muscles much when I speak. So I find if people pick up that I have an accent quickly, their eyes go for my lips because they're like, what's that guy saying? His cheeks aren't moving that much. I don't know if you've done any research on that, to what degree.
I mean, that was obviously a big question at the beginning. Well, some people aren't expressive and different cultures express in different ways. Indians, people will shake their head to say yes, for example. There's different cultural things.
There are other places where that is common.
They actually did when all of the neuroscience behind this was set up, they actually did it with different people from every different culture to build all the nuances in to actually take account of this. So the data would be measured on a set of people with the same types of reactions to assess how much the monitor should move. There's a lot of clever science behind it that the neuroscience team will have worked on, but I'm not in the neuroscience team.
I'm going to ask you a question that I wanted to ask. How do you stay in one place so long? I can't do that.
I basically, like I said, I started in the head office and then the company grew and I grew with it. The London office was built. America became our head office. We've now got offices in like 70 or 80 different countries, quite a few in each country. And, you know, we're a much, much bigger entity. So I don't feel like I'm in one place. And every time I've been working in a role where I've actually become a bit stale with it, I look to the next thing. And I've actually never done a job that existed in this company before I did it. So I've just made my own roles as I've moved along until I've ended up doing something I'm really loving, which is looking at everything, thinking about it, and then splurging it all out there, basically. So I like writing.
A couple of reactions to that. I mean, you obviously must also have a stable personality. I think that comes in. I can barely work in the same cafe one day from another or in the same place. I have to move around because my brain's just...
But my brain moves around with there's so many people here. I can be talking to someone in Australia one day and China the next day on different topics and different things. And I feel like every single day I'm learning something new. Today I'm learning about a podcast, my first ever podcast. So it's changing all the time. It's not a static job in any shape or form.
That's a common story I hear from people who've worked for a while in one particular company, that the company changed every sort of 3 to 4 years. 3 years is probably the longest I've ever stayed in one place. So for me, I'm like, that's so long. But like it's changing. I've been able to morph. I think that the advertising world struggles to really have that sense of growth. And I know that because I'm interviewing a lot of people who've gone from agency to in-house. And a lot of them, there's this narrative out there. Sometimes it's explicit, sometimes it's implicit, that you do your years in advertising. And then if you want a real career, you go client side, where potentially there are more ladders to climb, even though most people find that those ladders are difficult to climb if you've worked in an agency. So it's just interesting, the stories that we tell ourselves about all of these things. Because I know that, like, I get, if I'm not doing interesting stuff in 6 to 12 months, I had a very difficult time being patient with that. So different psychology, that's all.
Depends on the opportunity you have, I think, in the company to be able to do other stuff. I mean, if you're in a company that won't let you, then fair enough. I wouldn't have stayed here if they wouldn't let me sort of develop the way I wanted to develop. So I think I've been quite lucky because I've been here from the beginning. And so people will actually listen to what I say because they respect the fact that I have been here a long time. So yeah, it's partly based on the company you're in. And like I said, we've merged and grown. 12 companies have merged with us. We're all around the world now. So, you know, I could shoot off into media or I could go into brands or whatever. A lot of people go client side and can do secondments for 6 months with the client and then they tend to come back to us. So there's opportunity within one company. You just need a big global company to do that.
So you must be seeing a lot of data, less data or data, I guess, in real time, especially about humor. I don't know if you're looking at campaigns that maybe we'll see next year. What do you think is the near-term future of the use of humor in advertising?
Well, I'm currently, in the last month, I've run all the data from the last year and I've pulled out all the highest scoring ads. I've actually watched about 1,500 ads in the last month, me and some colleagues, because basically we're working out who's going to be winning the Kantar Creative Effectiveness Awards for next year. And we're definitely seeing humor. I can't give any spoilers away because obviously we're going to announce this as a big, big event next year. But you know, each year we look at what's coming out, what the people have liked. We just naturally seem to find different themes. I mean, last year we realized that otherworldliness was a theme that came out. A lot of ads just had this otherworldly feel. And whether that was like coming out of COVID or whatever, I don't know. But there's different themes. I mean, humor's actually, though, been a consistent theme throughout each year. And we always end up with the funny ads. But that's what I mean, feeling my way through 1,500 ads to find out which themes are coming out, what's a bit different from last year. It's still early days because we haven't selected our finalists or our winners to pull these themes yet. But if you want to talk to me again next year, I can tell you who they are and what actually came out, because I'll have a better idea early next year.
Have you ever watched that number of ads with this context, as in, you know, marking them, scoring them, grading them, categorizing them, and thought, oh, you know what, I might buy that product?
I don't need to think that, because I just look at the data and it tells me the 150 people who've watched it, did it persuade them?
But I mean, has an ad ever persuaded you as you've been analyzing it?
I have watched ads and actually probably bought the product as a result of it. You're going to ask me which one, what I bought, and I can't remember. I don't really go shopping much these days.
Fair enough. Awesome. So these two articles are on the Kantar.com website, the Kantar website. Do you publish anywhere else if people want to follow your thinking? Are you active anywhere?
Depending on what's in the article, things get picked up. I did a whole category learning this year on pharmaceutical advertising, because that's just massive and getting bigger. It's becoming one of the biggest categories out there, especially in America. So that's actually just gone out this week. And then that will potentially get picked up by pharmaceutical newspapers or whatever, so that it can be reused. You know, that things are re-edited and reused along the way. But I don't, if I produce it, it'll go on Kantar.com. Although, having said that, I've just written a piece for a magazine called Shift in London that the ad agencies create, and that goes out to the senior brand managers. So,
all right. So we've learned that humor has been up and down, but with a lot of down phases over the past couple of decades. We think it's on the up just a little bit. We believe that it's useful in persuading people, in getting into the memory, into the system one part of the brain. And there are at least these five types: slapstick, dark humor, wordplay, satire / irony, and laddish. So that's a good lesson for those people who are new to humor. And if you like humor, please watch some stand-up comedy in the next 48 hours. That's what I would say to anyone out there listening. It's good.
Content creators are your other, if you've got a brand you want to advertise, content creators within the different platforms, you know, they really get the humor. If you pick the ones who've done well and got lots of followers, they'll have a style that you never even knew existed. And it's funny, some little niche thing. And as an older person, I may not understand, but my sons will understand. So your content creators can also be used for humor along with your comedians.
Totally. Well, Polly Wynne Jones, thank you so much for joining me here on Sweathead today. I hope to catch up with you and the crew in the future to check in on the state of humor, something that I care very, very deeply about. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for having me on your podcast.
Peace.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com.